Thank you for joining us on this Palm Sunday. And isn't that a beautiful picture when you think about Palm Sunday, that our Savior comes riding into the city with praises and shouts of Hosanna, riding on a donkey, knowing he's going to give his life away. That is the kind of God that we serve. A God who is just willing to give his life for us. And so as we again think about today, as we enter into Easter, just be praising God this week. Be praising God that he has risen from the tomb. Well, the game of chess was one of the first strategy games to ever have been developed. It actually was developed back in the 600s in India, and originally it was known as Chaturanga. That was the original version and name of it, and it went from India, and then it spread to Persia, and then it spread over to the Middle East, and by the time we got to about 1000 AD in the feudal ages, it had reached Europe, and by about 1500, chess as we know it was kind of formed as the game that we often like to play. And it's one about testing your strategic thinking and planning ahead and maneuvering and outmaneuvering who your opponent is to ultimately checkmate your opponent into victory, right? That's the game of chess. And, you know, Esther, the story of Esther, I think really is a game of chess. We usually see that picture of God's sovereignty, his provision, which is a wonderful thing, and we'll take a look at that today. But if we're not paying attention, we miss all of the moves that was going on in the story of Esther, right? We just get to the end and we love what God did. But again, there's a beautiful picture of the game of chess that goes on. And I think if we are willing to keep that in mind as we go through our days and as we go through our lives, that there's a constant game of chess being played. That will probably help to relieve some of the stress and anxiety and tension that exist in our lives. Because I think a lot of times as we go through life, something bad happens and we're just hoping and praying for the last ditch miracle to come through. And don't get me wrong, God's miracles are powerful and they are wonderful when we see them. But I think if we're not always hanging on at the very end going, okay, now God has to show up, then maybe our blood pressure won't be 120 over 80, that maybe we can actually go through life and even through the hard times with a feeling of peace and so how do we get to the story of Esther again? We've been going through God's story, and God in the garden makes a promise that he's going to destroy the serpent, he's going to destroy evil, and he makes that promise through Abraham and through that lineage, and they come out of the Exodus, they come back into the promised land, and then the kingdom splits, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, and God sends the prophets after prophets after prophets and says, you are not following my ways. And if you don't get this right, there's going to be punishment. You're going to be exiled into a land that's not your own. And so the northern kingdom falls first to Assyria, and then the southern kingdom falls to Babylon. And that's where we're kind of at in the story, that God's people have disobeyed, and God has come through on that promise and said, now you're out of here. And so they were under Babylonian captivity. But during this time period, the Persians begin to rule, and now the Persians have taken over Babylon. But again, the Jews are still in captivity at this point. And if we remember back in Jeremiah, the prophet said, listen, there's going to be 70 years of captivity. There's going to be 70 years that you are going to have to serve out your jail sentence, if you will. And after those 70 years are done, that is when the Persians come in and they take over, and Cyrus becomes king. And in those early years of Cyrus, he says to the Jews, he said, you guys can go back home. And he begins to let them go back to the land that God had promised them. But when we get to the story of Esther, What we have is a group of Jews that still haven't gone back. They should have, but they've chose to remain. So in some sense, you have a group of Jewish people that have become Persianized. They've become comfortable with their life in Persia, and they're still hanging on as opposed to going back. And so that's what brings us now to Esther chapter 1, is you have this group of people still living under Persian authority. And we're going to see how God works in this. So in Esther chapter 1, starting in verse 1, it says this. It says, "This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush." That's another word for Egypt. "At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa, and in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all of his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes, and the nobles of the provinces were present. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace and for all the people from the least to the greatest who were in the citadel of Susa. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver rings and marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. Wine was served in goblets of gold, and each one different from the other, and the royal wine was abundant in keeping with the king's liberty. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink in his own way, for the king instructed all the wine servants to each man what he wished. And Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes." So the king of Persia, King Xerxes, for 180 days is displaying his wealth and his greatness. He's got this great banquet and he's displaying, "Look how majestic my kingdom is." And he throws this massive party where he basically says, "Drink as much as you want, drink how you want." Essentially what he did is he says, "I'm legalizing drunkenness for this time period because I want you guys to have the time of your lives." Now, the reason why he's doing this is because historically what has happened is the Greeks and the Persians had gotten themselves into a battle, and Xerxes' father, Darius, had gotten mad because the Greeks tried to help some Greek cities overthrow in the area of what is modern-day Turkey to overthrow Persian authority. And so they put down the rebellion and they say, "Now we're coming to the Greek mainland. And we're gonna take them over." And so Darius gets his men and they go over and they go to fight Greece and they lose. And Darius goes back with his tail between his legs. And Darius dies, and then his son takes over and he says, "I'm going to avenge my father's loss." And so this party is really his pep rally. This party is to get everybody on board to say, "Guys, look, we're pumping ourselves up because we're going to get ready to go back over to Greece." So this is the party that's going on. And so for 180 days, and this week-long drunken festival is going on. And as the rest of chapter 1 plays out, King Xerxes gets really high on the spirits and he calls for his wife Vashti. And he says, "Queen, I want you to come in and I want you to parade yourself around in front of everyone. I want you to show off your beauty." And Queen Vashti's like, "You're drunk. I'm not gonna subject myself to this. I'm not gonna parade myself around in front of your friends so you can feel good about yourself." And this infuriates the king. And so he goes to his nobles and advisors and he's like, "What do I do? The queen has defied me." And they're like, "Listen, if you don't do something, every woman in this empire is going to stand up to their husband. And there is no way we can let that happen. So you need to make a model of her that no woman will stand against her husband." And so that's what he decides to do. He casts out Queen Vashti and he said, "You're no longer queen. And now we have ourselves a new reality series called Who is the Next Pretty Persian? Because now we're going to find ourselves a new queen." And so in chapter 2, he begins the search. And he gets all the beautiful women around, and he puts them into the he puts them into a series of beauty treatments, and he says, "You guys are going to prep yourselves, and when it's your turn, you're going to parade yourself in front of the king." And if the king finds favor with you, you will become the new queen of Persia. And so in Esther chapter 2, here in verses 5 and 7, it says, "Now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai, son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, who had been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. Among those taken captive with Jehoiachin, king of Judah, Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. And this girl, who was also known as Esther, was lovely in form and features. And Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died." So Esther and Mordecai are taken into captivity under Babylonian times. And again, the Persians have now conquered over. And they're living in the capital of Susa, right? This is the capital of Persia. And she's found to be lovely. And so she starts to get all the beauty treatments. And very quickly, she sets herself apart. And she wins favor amongst the guys that are they're taking care of her. And he actually moves her into the best part of the capital, in the palace, because she's doing so well. And everybody that she comes in contact with just seems to love Esther. And so she's winning favor and favor. Right? She's the leading horse and the candidate here of who's going to get the final rose. And as she's progressing, and as she's going through this, Mordecai's on the side, and he's kind of giving her advice about what to do. And one of the things he says is, don't let them know of your background. Don't let them know of your Jewish identity. And so he continues to advise her, and then at one point, Mordecai overhears that there's a plot. And Esther, at this point, had gotten to a place where it was her turn, and she comes before the king, and the king's like, "Wow, she's the one," and he takes a crown of gold, and he puts her on her head, and he says, "Contest over, we have our new queen." And Mordecai's like, "Hey, now that you're queen, Esther, I heard something. I heard there's this plot to kill your husband, to kill the king." And so Esther goes, and he tells the king, and they find the guys, and they put him on a pole, and they kill him. And because of this, Mordecai gets his name essentially written into the history books for finding this plot out. And now we come to chapter 3, which is really the main plot of Esther. And in chapter 3, 1 through 6, it says, "After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than all other nobles. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. Then the royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, 'Why do you disobey the king's command?' Day after day they spoke to him, but he refused to comply, and therefore they told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behavior would be tolerated, for he told them he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all of Mordecai's people, the Jews throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes." So Esther's queen, Mordecai gets his name written in the history books, and this guy Haman, for whatever reason, is promoted. And Haman he's a pretty self-centered kind of guy, and he wants everybody to kneel and bow down. But every time he goes past Mordecai, Mordecai refuses. He says, "I'm not going to kneel any knee except to that of my God." And so he continues to refuse, and he finds out that, again, this guy's a Jew, and he says that, "You know what? It's not enough to just kill Mordecai." Haman says, "I will kill every Jew that exists in this entire empire." And so he goes to the king in verses 8 to 10, and he tells the king, and he said, "Hey, king, I just want you to know there's this group of people that live in your empire. They're not like us. They're different. They don't follow the same laws. They don't dress the same. They don't follow the same customs. You know, I really think they're going to be a problem for us. I really think we need to do something for the sake of your empire, king. For the sake of your empire, we got to step in and do something with this group of people." And he says, "Why don't you make a law that allows us to just go and exterminate them? Why don't you just make a law that just kills every single Jew, and then we have nothing to worry about?" And he says, "Look, if if you need a little help with this, I'll actually contribute some money to your treasury. How does that sound, right? I'll kick in a little bribe here to make sure this thing goes over. And King Xerxes is like, keep your money, don't worry about it. Go ahead, we'll make the law. And so a law was made that on a certain day, the Jews will be killed. And this is a law that cannot be revoked because the king's seal is on it. There's no taking it back. And so in chapter 4, Mordecai finds out about this. And he's in distress, and he communicates to Esther. He says, did you hear about this law? They're going to kill us. They're going to kill our people. Esther, you need to go to the king. You need to step in. You need to say something. And here's Esther's response in chapter 10, or in verse 10. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, all the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that he be put to death. The only exception to this is for the king to extend the gold scepter to him and spare his life. But 30 days have passed since I was called to the king. She's like, Mordecai, do you not know that there's this law? Like, I can't just go marching in whenever I want. I mean, if anybody comes bursting in and the king hasn't invited him, that is a death sentence. And so he hasn't actually invited me for 30 days. So I don't know the next time I'm going to get to go in. In Mordecai's response, verse 12, when Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows, but you have come to a royal position for such a time as this. Mordecai has a come to Jesus moment with Esther, and he's like, hey, listen up, princess. If you think that you're going to be exempt from this, you are mistaken. You are also going to die. So if you don't say something, that is going to mean the end of your life and mine. Now, Mordecai is wise, and he says, listen, I know that God will save his people, but if you don't step in, that's not going to come from us, and we will bear the wrath of that. So he says, get a clue. Haman hates us and wants us dead. And he throws out, which probably is one of the most famous lines of the book of Esther. And he says, Esther, I want you to think about this for a moment. I want you just to stop and consider the position you're in. Why is it that you've come to this place? Maybe it was for this exact moment that God has put you in this spot. So you can sit on the sidelines, Esther, or you can get in there and do something. And this pep talk does well for Esther. She changes her tune and she says, all right, let's pray for 3 days. Let's pray for 3 days. And after 3 days, I will go in. And if I perish, I perish. So she's willing to step into this for the sake of God's people. And so after 3 days, she goes in, and thankfully the king extends the scepter and he allows her to live. And she says, King, I got a request. And she says, anything. I'll give you half of the empire. Anything. You name it and I'll give it to you. And she says, oh, that's very sweet of you, King. I really appreciate it. But here's what I want. All I want is to sit down with you and Haman. Can we just have a dinner together? I think that would be really nice. And say, all right, let's plan it. Let's have it tomorrow. Sure, we'll agree, and we'll sit down, the three of us together. And at this point, Mordecai is still refusing to bow to Haman, and Haman is outraged, and he's high on life again. And he goes home, and he tells everybody, and he's, man, I hate this guy, Mordecai. But look how great I am. I'm so wealthy. I'm honored. I don't get it. And everybody says, man, Haman, you know what you should do? You should just get rid of him. I mean, you're going to have this big dinner with the king, with the king. You don't want to be thinking about Mordecai. So why don't you prep and kill Mordecai in the morning, and then you can go to your banquet and you can just relax and enjoy. And he says, oh, that's a great idea. And so Haman goes and he basically makes this pole and he goes, I am going to impale Mordecai on this pole. And so Haman is completely joyous as to what's going on. And so now we come to chapter 6. And so the king's having trouble sleeping. And they had the banquet, and he says, what's going on, Esther? And Esther's like, yeah, I'll tell you again tomorrow. We'll come back another day. And so the king can't sleep that night. And he gets up, and he's like, I don't know what to do. And he pulls out the old history book, and he starts to read this history book. And he goes, man, there's this guy Mordecai. I never properly thanked him for saving my life. Yeah, I really should do something for him. I got to find a way to properly honor this man. And so the next morning, he calls in Haman, and he goes, Haman, he goes, how do I honor somebody that really deserves to be honored? And of course, Haman's thinking it's about him. And he goes, well, King, I'll tell you what I would do, because he's thinking whatever I say now is what's going to come to me. And so in chapter 6 verse 6, it says, when Haman entered, the king asked him, what should be done for the man the king delights to honor? Now Haman thought to himself, who is there that the king would rather honor than me? And so he answered the king, for the man the king delights to honor, have them bring a royal robe the king has worn and a horse the king has ridden, one with a royal crest placed on its head, and then let the robe and the horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes. Then let the robe, the man the king delights to honor, and lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honor. And he says, what a great idea. The king is like, Haman, you are so smart. And he's probably just laughing with delight. He's like, oh, I can't wait to honor this man. And Haman's like, yep, here it comes. And he's like, go get Mordecai and do everything that you just said. And I want you to parade him around the city. I am sure in that moment, all of the life of Haman had been sucked out of him. Head drops. Jaw, eyes. I mean, talk about your all-time biggest backfire, right? He was pretty sure that he was going to get this. And out of nowhere, he now has to parade around the guy that he wants to kill. But we're not done, because he has the first banquet. He was all excited, and he's parading Mordecai around, and he wants to kill him, but now he's got to come back to the second banquet. Because Esther said, hey, I was going to tell you the first time, but just let's have another meal together, and I'll tell you again. And so in chapter 7, I'm sure Haman has gone in, and he's probably dreading now. Right, the first one he was ecstatic, but now he's probably like on edge. And so they're sitting, and Haman's probably hot under the collar, his stomach's probably in knots, his mind is probably racing, he's probably furious. And the king goes, Esther, what did you want to tell me again? You said you would tell me today. What is it? And she says, oh, king, in verse 3, Queen Esther answered, if I have found favor with you, O king, and if it pleases your majesty, grant me my life. This is my petition. And spare my people, this is my request. For I and my people have been sold to destruction and slaughter and annihilation. If we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept it quiet, because no such distress would justify disturbing the king. She's like, king, we're set to die. Like, if I just had to be a slave, it's fine, but we're going to be killed. I'm going to be killed. And King Xerxes says, ask Queen Esther, who is he? Where is the man who has dared to do such a thing? And Esther says in verse 6, The adversary and enemy is this vile Haman. I mean, could you just picture it? Haman's already on edge. He thought it was going to be him. He's not. And Esther is like, we're going to die. And Haman's like, oh my gosh, that was the law that I made. And the king is like, who would do it? And Esther's like, it was him. What is Haman going to do now? And Xerxes gets up and he's full of rage and he goes out to the garden to compose himself. And he's walking around and he's thinking to himself, what has just happened? And while this is going on, to make matters worse, Haman is now in there alone with Esther. And he's pleading with Esther. He's like, you got to do something. You got to save me. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And he trips over the couch and he falls on top of her just as the king walks back in and is like, how dare you try to molest my queen? And so the pole that was designed to kill Mordecai ends up being the pole that kills Haman. But we're not done with the story, because remember, we have a law that can't be undone. Haman is dead, but we haven't solved everything just yet. And so in chapter 8, as Esther continues to plead for her people, and she's like, I'm glad that Haman's gone, but what about this law? What are you going to do? My people are scheduled for a death sentence. And the king's like, well, I made a law I can't take back. I'm sorry. What I have said is set in stone. It needs to happen. And so in verse 8, the king goes, well, how about I just make another law? Right? I mean, I can do that. I'm the king. And so in verse 8, he says, write another decree in the king's name in behalf of the Jews as seems best to you, and seal it with the king's signet ring. For no document written in the king's name can be sealed with his ring can be revoked. Make another law that we can't take back. And at once the royal secretaries were summoned, and on the 23rd day of the third month of Sivan, they wrote out all of Mordecai's orders to the Jews and to the satraps, governors, and nobles of the 127 provinces stretching from India to Cush. These orders were written in the script of each province and language in each people, and also to the Jews in their own language and script. Mordecai wrote in the name of King Xerxes, sealed the dispatches with the king's signet ring, and sent them by his mounted couriers who rode fast horses, especially bred for the king. The king's edict granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and protect themselves, to destroy, kill, and annihilate any armed force of nationality or providence that might attack, and their women and children to plunder the property of their enemies. The day appointed for the Jews to do this in all the provinces of King Xerxes was the 13th day of the 12th month of the month of Adar. A copy of the text of the edict was made to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality, so the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on the enemy. So the king makes a law and says, you know what? I made a law that says you guys have to die, but now I've made a law that says you guys can defend yourselves. I've made a law that says get ready. And so what happens? Now we go into the training montage, right? The Jews start to arm themselves. They start looking at the map and they're planning strategy. They start doing the push-ups and the sit-ups. Like I picture it like the old Rambo part where he's got the headband on and he ties it tight. And to summarize what happens in the end, because of this law that goes out all over the place, many of the people actually got afraid of the Jews. And some of them actually joined them. And it even says that even some of the nobles and the officials actually joined the side of the Jews to protect them from their enemies. And in the end, 75,000 of the enemies of the Jews are killed, including Haman's 10 sons. And the tradition of Purim is established, which celebrates this commemoration of the story of Esther. And that tradition still goes on today, where they hold a holiday in the Jewish faith to celebrate how God saved his people. And so as we've been going through God's story, we have story after story after story of God sovereignly protecting his people. And I could finish right now and just say this was a good story. I don't think we need anything else. The Bible speaks for itself. But I want us to see something a little bit different. Remember how I started? I said life is like a game of chess. And I think the story of Esther is a chess game that was going on. And if we view it that way, we start to see things differently. You know, in the game of chess, you've got black and white pieces, right? And it becomes symbolic of good and evil, light and dark, purity and sin. And again, chess is constantly maneuvering around on a board to try to checkmate your opponent. But the world of Hollyweird has done us a huge disservice. See, it's taught us to not fear the spiritual realm. It's taught us to not look behind the curtain that there is something going on behind the scenes on a daily basis. See, Hollywood told us that the devil is a guy in a red outfit with a French mustache and a pitchfork. What Hollywood taught us is don't fear horror movies because they're not real. When the reality is, the spiritual world certainly exists. You know, spiritual warfare takes place. We throw that out sometimes when things seem really bad, but it is true. And every single day, there are spiritual forces at work against you and I. In Ephesians 6, it says, "For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms." You know, we look at people and we condemn people and we think they're bad people. But what I need us to realize is behind the bad that exists is Satan trying to work that out. And so we have a game of chess. So when God's people are sent into captivity and God allows them to come back, but some of those Jews stayed, it's like Satan has put in front of God a chessboard. And he said, "Let's play for the souls of your children." And God says, "All right, let's play." And so in Esther's chapter 1 and 2, they start to move the pieces around. And they're moving on the board little by little. They're beginning their strategies and they're beginning their plots. And nothing major happens. Queen Vashti is vanquished and Esther comes into that role. And both sides are feeling pretty good. And then chapter 3 comes along. And Satan starts to take God's pieces. Haman is elevated because Mordecai refuses to believe, and another pawn falls. Now, there's a very critical mistake that happens in the game way back in God's children's history. If we went all the way back to 1 Samuel chapter 15, Saul was king, and when God brought them into the promised land, he said, "You need to get rid of these people." And they failed to do it. And he said, "Saul, I need you to go and destroy the Amalekites. Because when my people were coming out of the Exodus, the Amalekites stood in their way, and God said, now I'm going to do justice to them." So he said, "Saul, I need you to destroy them completely." And Saul went out and destroyed them. But you know what? He didn't destroy everything. He left the animals alive, and he left the king alive, King Agag. And the prophet shows up and he says, "What's going on? God told you to kill everything." And he tries to make this excuse about wanting to honor God. And he said, "No, the instruction was I need you to kill everything." And Saul failed to do that. And so Saul has the throne stripped away. And he let that king live. And then the prophet had to come in and kill the king. But before that king was killed, at some point, he has a king. He has a son. And that son lived. And that son had a son, and that son had a son, and that son had a son, all the way down to the line of Haman. See, if Saul had done what he had done, Haman may never have been in that position. And so Satan uses that to his advantage. And he sets up his moves to attack because he says, now I can see the opening. And he starts the plot. He says, now I can see how I'm going to get victory here. And so he has the law made that every Jew has to die because he hates the Jews because Mordecai is refusing to bow down. And he makes it with a law that can't be revoked. And so he moves his rook into position. But remember, God's playing too. And God has moved Mordecai and Esther into their proper spots. And it seems bleak. Mordecai, Esther, what are you going to do? And Esther's like, I don't know, I can't do anything. If I go in, the king's going to kill me. And he says, no, you need to go in. I know things seem bad right now in the game, but you need to go in and do something. And you know, I think what Esther did there is a lot of times what we do. We get complacent in life. See, she was in a position of authority and a position of power, and she was like, I should be okay. You know, what am I going to do? And I think for us, we get to a place sometimes where life is good. My kids are going to church. I can pay the bills. We're getting ready to go on vacation. I'm going to sit back and rejoice and just enjoy life. And we lull ourselves into a false sense of security, not knowing that when we do that, we give the enemy the opportunity to move into position. Because every moment, Satan is moving pieces to set us up to fail. But Mordecai's pep talk, I think that's the moment when God looks across the game board and just starts to smile. Because when all seems lost, God has been setting up Satan himself. And so Satan continues to move the pieces, right? He goes to the banquet, he's feeling good, and he's like, I hate Mordecai. And they're like, put him on a pole. And he's like, yeah. And at this point, Satan thinks he's got it. He's got Haman in position. He's got the law made. He is about ready to kill Mordecai. And it's as if Satan had slid his last piece into place and leans over to God and says, check. And then God starts to move. And he moves out of check. And he moves out of check. And he starts to move his pieces around. And then he begins to reverse the flow of the game. Because again, it would seem the game was over, right? It seemed that Satan had set him up to win. But you know, after the first banquet, I thought it was interesting. Why didn't Esther just say something in the first banquet? Why didn't she just tell him that first time? Because God had another move on the board. Because remember what happens that night, the king can't sleep. See, God needed the king to read the history books because he needed the king to remember Mordecai. And so God's now starting to toy with Satan. Just when Satan thinks he's won, he hasn't. And so then when Haman comes back and he says, I should be honored this way, he's humiliated. And it's Mordecai who gets the praise. And so after the second banquet, when it's revealed that Haman is the one who was the enemy, it's now that God is on the offensive and he starts to pluck the pieces off the board. And when Haman is killed, it's like he's taken Satan's queen. And he says, now what are you going to do? Now, God probably could have finished this off right here, but I think God's like, no, I'm going to mess with you a little bit more. I'm going to take every last pawn off the board till the only thing you have left, Satan, is your king. And so he allows the king to make a law that he says the Jews can defend themselves. And then the Jews go out and they kill 75,000 of the enemy. And it's at that point when God moves his final piece and he says, checkmate. And God has won and protected his people yet again. You know, we need to remind ourselves of something. 1 Peter 5:8 says this. It says, "Be alert and of sober mind. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour." Every day, the devil is out to get us. Every day, behind the scenes, if we are not watching, we are putting ourselves in a position to be swallowed up and eaten alive. But also understand this, that every day that that lion is out there prowling, looking to devour us, God is on the hunt, and God will slay that lion trying to kill us. And why is Satan so insistent on this game of chess? Well, because remember, what did God say in the garden? "I will bring forth a child that will destroy Satan, that will destroy you." And so all in the Old Testament, Satan is doing everything he can from trying to get that child to come. And we know that child came. He came born of a virgin. And then when Jesus is about to start his ministry, it's not surprising that Satan tries one last take. And he says, "Look, Christ, I'll give you anything. Throw yourself off this cliff. I'll give you the kingdoms of this world." Because Satan knows what is about to happen with this child that was born. And he is doing everything he can to make every final move to stop Jesus from going to the cross. But God is always one step ahead. And what do we know? That Jesus went to the cross, he died, and he rose again, and he has sealed up the victory. And now Satan is left with knowing that his time is coming, that one day he will be destroyed, and he can't stop it. And the only thing he can do is try to take down as many of us as he can with him. So this is a book about God's sovereignty. This is a book about God's protection. It is about God's faithfulness and how he is going to redeem his people from death. But this is also a book that teaches us that, again, every day there is a battle that wages on for our soul that we do not understand. And when all seems lost, when all hope seems gone, and we are on the verge of destruction, just know that God has been moving in our favor every piece at a time. So in the game of life that we call chess, Christ is king, and he has and always will be the one that will proclaim in the end, checkmate. Let's pray. Father, thank you for, every week we praise you. Lord, you are glorious. You are infinite beyond all wisdom. Lord, you hold not only our lives, but all of eternity in your hand. And Lord, you are fighting a battle for us, and that battle was won at the cross, and we are yours forever. God, I thank you that you love us. I thank you that you are moving. And Lord, I just pray that we are aware of what lurks behind. I pray that we do not diminish the powers of darkness, but Lord, I pray and praise the fact that the power of you is stronger than any force that can come against us. We are on the winning team. So let us go in this world with that kind of confidence, knowing that we have won this game because of what you have done at the cross. May that give us peace. May that give us comfort in the trials and struggles that lie ahead. Amen.